The title of this session is Tales from the Oil Patch, from Canada to the Midwest. The format is very, very simple. I'm first of all going to ask the speakers in alphabetical order to identify themselves, give a small biographical sketch of some kind, and give us some idea of a few of the points that they're going to tackle in the session. As soon as possible, since we have to stop at 3:30 apparently, as soon as possible, then we'll go to the floor and give you a chance to debate, argue, agree with, or whatever with the speaker. So we'll start out with Henry Henderson, Director of Midwest Program, Natural Resources Defense Council.
Thank you very much. I rarely am the first to go in alphabetical order, so I'm going to relish this experience. I am indeed Henry Henderson. I direct the Midwest Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Natural Resources Defense Council is an environmental advocacy group that began in 1970 and uses law, science, and the power of 1.2 million members to advocate for change in energy efficiency, energy economy, toxics, and particularly climate change. I'm very pleased to be involved in this discussion today on tar sands. The Midwest is the epicenter of proposed refining for tar sands in the world. It is affected in Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and now South Dakota as the focus for refining tar sands. That has a huge impact on where we live as part of the Midwest community, and it has a huge impact on us as part of the Great Lakes community. The Monk Center at the University of Toronto issued an interesting report called Tar Sands, a Pollution Delivery System for the Great Lakes. This is the context in which a great deal of the debate moves forward, and there will be back and forth about how actually devastating or not this is to the environment. What it means in terms of national security is another point of discussion here. But what I would like to talk about, particularly with an audience of journalists, is the framing of the question itself. When we talk about climate change, when we talk about coal, we talk about dirty energy and fossil fuels, so often the framing of it, particularly in the oil context, is framed as a question of what is in the interest of the public, which is coterminous with the interest of oil companies. I think we need to ask this question and press very hard on the assumptions that frame this discussion. Is the era of burning oil with us and with us eternally, lest we fall into economic decline and our civilization fall apart? I think it's a fundamentally flawed way of talking about it. And I think what we need to be doing, particularly for journalists pursuing public discourse, is questioning how accurate the oil companies' framing of their narrow own security questions as a question of public interest has been so successful, and is it not time to reframe this as a question of how do we in fact get away from burning fossil fuels and start investing in a clean energy economy that is safe, does not subsidize itself off of the lungs of asthmatic children, and does not put us in harm's way with regard to international security and economic shocks that we have had for the past 150 years of dependence on oil.
That could I think, keep us going way past 3:30, which is a good sign. The second speaker is Tom Huffaker, Vice President, Policy and Environment, Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers.
Thank you. Obviously, I work for CAP. We're the representatives of the upstream oil and gas industry in Canada. We represent about 90% of production. I, by background, and a recently former American Foreign Service officer, I obviously take a view and that I never would have taken the job if I didn't believe there was substantial alignment between the interests of the Canadian energy production sector and the interests of the United States. I would definitely be happy to talk about some of the questions we started with, but you know, want to just kind of jump into one thing real quickly, a little bit of facts around greenhouse gases and the oil sands people tend to read about how the production of the oil sands is three times or four times as greenhouse gas inefficient as other traditional sources. As you know, we're moving towards a heavier oil world. We can have a discussion around that off-oil world, which I think we probably all think will happen eventually, but we probably have very different perspectives on time frames. But if we look at oil sands on a full life cycle basis, that 300% difference in carbon footprint collapses down to about 5 to 15%. And with changes in technology over time, that difference is going to become even smaller. And as a Californian, I always enjoy pointing out to audiences that most oil sands production actually has a full life cycle carbon footprint lower than the thermal oil production of California, which I note that nobody in California politics ever talks about. Happy to discuss, obviously, land issues, water issues, air issues. We recognize and the fact that there are environmental issues around the oil sands, and we're very committed to addressing them and continuing to become more efficient and reducing those impacts. But I think the energy security piece is very, very real. A balancing of energy, environment, economy is very, very real. And if you look at the recent statements coming out of the Obama administration, particularly on pipeline permits and statements coming out of their international energy advisor to Secretary Clinton, I think you see a clear trend line that the Obama administration to some extent shares that view. It's about environment, but it's also about energy security, and it's also about the economy, and we've got to try to advance all those objectives together. Happy to talk about anything on your minds around oil sands.
Good. Third speaker and the final one for this opening remarks is Andrew Nikiforuk, a freelance writer and author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent.
Well, good afternoon. I've been a journalist that has been living now in Alberta for more than 20 years. I'm basically a business journalist and an investigative journalist, magazine writer, and I've largely focused on oil and gas issues. You can't help but notice that when you live in a place and when 700,000 people pour into it over the course of a decade, not necessarily to make a living but to make a killing, that the whole nature of your place has changed. And as a result, I've done a lot of deep reporting on the tar sands for the last 3 years. Just two or three quick points I want to throw out there. The first is that bitumen is not light oil. This is a radically different resource than light oil. Industry calls it unconventional. Total calls it extreme. Statoil calls it difficult. I call it dirty oil. And I do so because of its capital intensity, its energy intensity, and its carbon intensity. It's all vastly different than that of light oil. So when your society begins this shift from light oil to heavy oils and then to bitumen, which has such a low API gravity that it won't move through a pipeline unless you dilute it with light oil or natural gas condensate, that a major shift has taken place in the scheme of things. And that ordinary people should know that shifting from the conventional to the unconventional is a huge and dramatic shift. You'll probably notice Tom will be talking about the oil sands. I'll be talking about the tar sands. For the simple reason, the National Center for Upgrading Technology in Ottawa defines bitumen as more than 50% pitch or asphalt. So if it looks like asphalt, smells like asphalt, behaves like asphalt, then I'm going to call it tar. And to me, it just conveys the fact that the resource is not oil floating on top of sand. The resource needs extensive upgrading and extensive complex refining. And so it's a different ballgame altogether. And the last thing I would say here is that my government in Alberta and also the Canadian government quite often regards the tar sands as primarily, you know, it's a PR exercise. We have to go out there and we really have to sell this thing and make it look cleaner. When in fact, really, what we have is a public policy failure that and I've made this argument consistently, that we've developed the resource much too quickly and much too rapidly, and we're now having difficulty handling both the economic and environmental fallout of doing so. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andrew. We have no fourth speaker, TB8. We hope to have at one point, but it didn't. He or she didn't materialize. Okay, would anybody like to start discussion or questions or from the floor?
Well, the question is how we greenhouse gases produced by the oil sands can allegedly be 200 to 300% of conventional crude, or on the other hand, 10 to 15%. And what this really gets down to is, are you calculating just the production footprint, or are you calculating the full life cycle from well to wheels? Which I think a lot of people have come to believe, certainly including at least some in the environmental community, have come to believe is probably the appropriate measure. Because then you're factoring in all the impacts of the production, whether it's the land impacts, the impacts of putting it in a tanker and having the tanker burn fuel, bringing it across, whether you're in a country where an awful lot of the natural gas is burned and wasted rather than used. If you factor all that in, and we can argue a little bit around the range of what the difference is, but there's a lot of studies out there showing the difference is 5 to 15%. Some will run a little higher than that, 20 towards 25 or 30. The Jacobs study that's out on the Internet, we believe, is probably the highest quality, most serious study. It tends to show the range difference to be about 5 to 15%. And that's relative to the kind of mainstream basket of American crudes that are used in the U.S. There are other outliers. The Nigerian is heavier. As I said, the Californian is heavier. Venezuelan and some Mexican is heavier. We are moving towards a world of heavier crudes, and you know, whatever we call them, it probably is important to look at these sort of apples to apples in terms of their carbon footprints and their other footprints. And I actually would agree with Andrew that as we move from a light oil world, or at least a light oil dominated world, to a heavier and heavier oil dominated world, that is a fairly significant change and something that's worth discussion.
Henry, before you started your answer to that question, you repeated the question, which was a very, very good idea because it was quite difficult to hear just between here and the back of them. So if everybody on the panel would try to repeat the question, if possible, before you get into your answer. Yes.
I think the question was speaking about the water footprint of tar sands extraction and development, in addition and separate from the carbon footprint. I think the water issue is a very important one in putting this in the context of what is happening, both in terms of contamination of water use in Alberta itself, which is threatening the third largest watershed in North America, and what it means in our community here in the Great Lakes region. We are looking at, in the development and expansion of refineries, many of which are on the edge of the Great Lakes, a series of new permits that have to be issued that involve increased contaminant loading within the Great Lakes ecosystem. It is one of the largest freshwater ecosystems in the world, 20% of the world's fresh water. There's been a huge effort within the Great Lakes community over the last 5 years to create a new regulatory structure to protect that water and improve how it functions, given the fact that it has been highly depleted in terms of water quality and has been, in many respects, highly subscribed by users. We are involved, Natural Resource Defense Council, in litigating the issue of release of new contaminants into the Great Lakes watershed. It is a downstream impact of this development. Permits having been issued by the state of Indiana for increased loading of contaminants into Lake Michigan, and a significant increase of contaminants into the air, which have a deposition impact into the Great Lakes. We see this as a community threat in terms of increased loading of contaminants into the Great Lakes, which now presently are in a situation where you cannot eat the fish that are captured in there. There are problems with regard to swimming. There are drinkability considerations. So our view is that the impact of the tar sands refining and tied to the tar sands extraction in Alberta creates a water threat, and water being one of the truly non-renewable resources we have that is dependent, that we are dependent upon. So we see getting the understanding of that footprint impact as being a gigantic part of the policy questions that have to be answered in terms of continued extraction of and refining of tar sands. I don't know if you want to say something about the Alberta specific part of this.
The water intensity of the development of this resource is quite significant. For the mining operations, it takes on average about 3 barrels of fresh water to produce 1 barrel of bitumen. And then 90% of the water that's taken out of the Athabasca River ends up in tailings ponds, all of which are unlined and that now cover about 130 square kilometers of boreal forest. Now, that's an enormous liability. The tailings ponds in themselves are an enormous liability. There are other serious liabilities in terms of groundwater use, in particular for the steam plants or what's known as steam-assisted gravity drainage, and the lack of proper baseline data. The government, there was a really important report by the Council of Canadian Academies that came out just a couple of months ago, basically saying, okay, nobody can say this project is sustainable because we haven't done the baseline data yet on groundwater and what the impacts on groundwater will be. And they could extend over an area the size of Florida. There are some very important freshwater aquifers in this region as well. The other issue with water, and there's so many of them, would simply be acid rain. There's so much NOx and SOx is being produced in this region that we are developing an acid rain problem in northern Saskatchewan, which is a bit like northern Minnesota. Lots of phenomenal boreal lakes, where a problem never existed before. So the water intensity of the resource is again an indication of its energy intensity, and so you've got this really bizarre energy water nexus at work, where you've got a very dirty resource. It requires more water, either treatment of water, use of water, or pollution of water.
Thank you. I'm not going to comment much on the U.S. piece, the refinery piece. I'm just going to sort of leave that at, you know, having confidence in the U.S. legal and political system to sort this out in the fullness of time. I'm going to talk about what I know more about, which is the obviously the piece in Alberta. The allocation from the Athabasca River to the oil sands is about 3% of average flow. That's not as simple as it sounds because there's low flow in winter, there's high flow in summer. Obviously that has to be balanced out. The usage is probably on the order of 2%. Nobody's licensed to put any contaminated water back in the river. The water is recycled repeatedly in the production process. Increasingly, as we move from mining to what's called in situ production, which is drilling-based production, and that's going to ultimately be about 80% of the production, the water that's used is going to be non-potable rather than fresh water. The amount of water per barrel of production is declining per barrel as the CO2 footprint is. There certainly have been health questions raised around these issues, around this issue related to the water in the river and the communities that live in the area. There have been a number of studies. Our view is the serious epidemiological studies have not found a link between production and health issues, but there are communities that do appear to have fairly abnormal levels of cancers and some other issues. We support the idea of further studies to get to the bottom of that. It's also noteworthy, and people should have in mind, there's bitumen that naturally seeps into the Athabasca River. It's been doing it for tens of thousands of years. We really would need to sort out definitively whether the production side is increasing that or that's really mostly the natural baseline. Little reference to the NOx and SOx levels in the area. Definitely has risen as there's been production in the area. We want to work on getting that down. May not surprise an American audience, but always surprises Canadian audiences that the NOx and SOx levels in the Fort McMurray area is in fact lower than any of the major cities in Canada. That's not necessarily a good thing, that it's that there is a NOx and SOx level, where admittedly there used to be almost none, but it's well within the bounds of what most Canadians living in Canadian cities are exposed to on a daily basis.
Yes. Could you identify yourself? Sorry, yes.
I would just like to, on the issue of the water footprint and contamination, I'd just like to highlight the nature of the claim, Mr. Huffaker, that there is no one is licensed to release contaminants into the Athabasca, and as if that is a response to the nature of the contamination. Andrew underscored the fact that you've got these gigantic impoundments that can actually be seen from outer space of highly contaminated water as a result of the extraction, that in fact when birds land on it, they tend to die in large quantities, and it is extraordinarily toxic material that is in impoundments that are not lined. It has whether somebody is licensed or not, is irrelevant to whether or not we have a huge exposure that is a threat to the public health and safety and a contamination of a highly limited resource upon which we all depend. I also think that if there is a serious, I'm not sure if I heard this right, if the massive unprecedented extraction of bitumen has had any increase in the release of bitumen into the watershed is a legitimate question. I'm not sure if that was actually raised or was a sort of like a rhetorical trope that you kind of hope no one would notice. Is that a serious point? Is it a serious point that the massive extraction of bitumen might not be an increase of release of bitumen into the environment from naturally occurring?
Into the river, yes. That is a serious point. There's monitoring upstream and downstream, and there's not a lot of evidence that there's been an increase in the amount of release into the river as the result of mining.
I would say that underscores a question with regard to the adequacy of the monitoring and if it is not set up in order to avoid detecting what is obviously sort of a priori experience.
Yes.
Peter
Carley,
I'm a freelance writer based in British Columbia.
Okay.
Could you repeat the question?
Sure. It's basically what would the impact of a low-carbon fuel standard nationally in the United States or in California, I assume directed at sort of what would the impact be on the oil sands and oil sands production, on the marketability of the product. Obviously, it really depends on how you structure a low-carbon fuel standard. We tend to think that the California approach, which rolls the very, very heavy California oil into the basket so that it doesn't get exposed to the low-carbon fuel standards is sort of inherently an unfair and actually not very rational approach. Because if the objective is to, you know, to manage carbon and limit carbon, to allow their own extremely heavy oil into the basket unregulated doesn't seem to us very effective. We as an organization actually embrace the idea of putting a price on carbon. As all the Canadians in the room will know, but maybe not all the Americans, Alberta already places a $15 per ton price on carbon for major emitters. Now, this is intensity-based, and we can have a long argument about whether or not intensity-based is meaningful. I would argue anything that's collected real money, over $100 million so far, is meaningful, especially relative to other jurisdictions not having any such price on carbon. Well, many of our members are. Yes. I'm not personally that I'm aware of. So I'm going to connect back to low-carbon fuel standards. It's our view that let's put a price on carbon and make every molecule out there deal with that price on carbon rather than deciding that there are good molecules and bad molecules of carbon. We believe that's a much more efficient approach to avoid things like low-carbon fuel standards and simply get to a carbon price, whether it's through a cap and trade or through a tax, and let the most efficient producers of energy deal with that carbon price.
Well, there are a number of issues here. The one thing that California has that Alberta and Canada don't have is an air conservation board. So they're actively trying to manage their carbon. So they can fit a low-carbon fuel standard into that very important body. In fact, I would make the argument that Canada should never have started exploiting the tar sands without a similar air conservation board. The other issue here, and I think Peter asked the question about, well, the carbon intensity of the resource. Industry is arguing it's 10 to 15%, and other people are saying, well, it's much more. I think on average it really is two to three times more. But the real truth is that we don't have good transparent data based on real live emissions from these projects. And the projects all have different carbon intensities based on the production methods they're using or are based on the fuels that they're using. So there is an extreme range here. And some of the projects are absolutely atrocious in terms of the kilograms of CO2 being emitted by barrel, as high as 217 kilograms per barrel. That's from well to tank. That is, you know. So the lack of transparency. The University of Toronto has come up with really good study on the life cycle analyses here and identified all the problems. The two studies that Tom referenced were commissioned by the government of Alberta. Canada's top climate change scientist, David Keith, and a number of others have said, look, these studies are not really good. They lack transparency, and they had a lot of questions about these studies. So, so we really don't know how big the problem is. Quite in many cases, we're not even factoring in, fugitive emissions, emissions from tailings ponds, emissions from deforestation, and on you go. So it's a big question mark. Personally, I think as many places that can go towards a low carbon fuel standard will be really driving a transition to the next economy. I think it's basically a good thing. The Canadian government has gone on record that they are opposed to a low-carbon fuel standard in California.
Yeah. I think they're also opposed to a low-carbon fuel standard nationally in the United States, which is why they're spending a great deal of time, the Canadian lobbyists, on fighting that, in addition to which threatening to take it to World Trade Organization in the event that there is a low-carbon fuel standard passed as part of climate legislation in the United States. There's also the point that the 1998 energy bill had within it a limit on federal government buying buying fuel that had a higher carbon footprint than traditional sweet oil. And that, in fact, is one of those tools, policy tools, that has had an effect driving the U.S. Air Force, for instance, in investing heavily in alternative fuels for the Air Force because of meeting needs for the Air Force and to have a genuine approach toward energy security, not relying upon fossil fuels to drive our Air Force.
Yes.
Hillary Brown, freelancer. I'm interested in hearing some more detail about the in-situ technologies and processes, and when they're expected to be come into use. And then, Andrew, if you could expand on your remarks that you made at the award ceremony last night with respect to why Americans should worry when we start extracting oil shale in-situ.
I'm definitely be happy to let Andrew answer the oil shale piece. In situ production is basically a technology where you use drilling to extract the oil sands that lie too deep for lifting off the overburden and producing it by mining. The vast majority of the resource does, in fact, exist too deep. At this point, the bulk of the production comes from mining. Over time, about 80% of the extractable resource will come from basically from drilling. There's actually already a shift underway. There is already several hundred thousand barrels a day, and I wish I knew the number precisely, of the 1.3 million that is production from in situ production. So this isn't experimental. This is up and running in a big way. It's a very new technology, and what is experimental is that the number of different ideas that are out there and being worked out to try to drive down improve the energy efficiency of in situ production. Interestingly, and it may surprise people, the reality right now is in terms of carbon footprint, carbon intensity, mining is actually slightly lower in CO2 output than is the in situ. The in situ, however, is a very new technology. There are a number of different approaches we can get into, and there may be some of them outlined in some of the materials we left in the back that we believe will drive the numbers from in situ production down very, very significantly. Obviously, the land and surface impact of in situ production is a lot lower than it is with mining, and the water issues are different. It's going to be mostly done with subsurface non-potable water. It's not that there are no issues around that, but there's no... Nobody envisions any in situ production requiring drawing water from the Athabasca River. I'll stop there.
I'll just say a few words about in situ. It means in place in Latin, but I just refer to the technology as steam plants. And there's a variety of technologies out there. The steam plants have been commercially operative for about 8 years. The technology goes back about 25 years. Almost all of them are having problems in the sense that all of them are using more natural gas to create more steam than they started out with. Due to steam leaks, the steam it goes into a formation and then escapes or somewhere else or comes to surface. So they're using more water and more natural gas. The technological solution to a lot of these issues, I think, is still a long ways away, especially when you look at the progress reports for these projects, which by law have to be posted. The Energy Resources Conservation Board, their in-situ progress reports are really make interesting but quite long reading. Because you begin to realize all of the issues here from use of natural gas, extreme use of natural gas. I mean, 20% of Canada's natural gas demand is all in the tar sands now, and mostly for the steam plants. So the steam plants have the largest carbon footprint, the largest energy intensity footprint. The water issues are extremely significant, even though they will be largely using salt water. But we don't know how much the saltwater formations are connected to freshwater formations and how these are all related to the Athabasca River. And if you start, pulling from, one part of the bucket, another part of the bucket is going to go down. Plus, you're creating huge empty spaces in the ground with the bitumen extraction, and over time that will fill with water, either surface water or groundwater. Now, what are the implications here in terms of oil shale? Well, basically, what you've seen in Canada is increasingly being regarded by some people in industry, not all people, and by some governments, state governments in the United States, particularly in Utah, and a few other places, that this is a model for unconventional resource development in the United States. And I think the implications are pretty dramatic. I mean, we've sacrificed a fair amount of landscape, a fair amount of water. We've got a black eye globally in terms of some of these environmental issues. We're also sacrificing an enormous amount of energy to get, you know, some more oil. And the implications for oil shale development are simply this, that oil shale is a degree dirtier than bitumen. And the U.S. Congress came out with a report last year where they basically said, you know, thank God those Canadians are doing this, because the carbon costs, the energy costs, and the capital costs, plus the water costs, are so extreme that we're glad that they're doing this first and not us.
Can I just ask one?
Yeah.
This is maybe a little bit off the subject, but with oil shale, isn't there also a problem that the leftover slag is actually more volume than it had before extraction, so that you've got a lot more stuff left over than you started with?
Well, it would depend on how you would produce it. I think the method that industry is looking to most at this point in time would be the use of electrodes. So you would be heating up the shale up to 600 degrees centigrade over a year or two or 3 year period, and then and then producing the kerogene or the gas that's coming off from that. That would probably require nuclear power for that kind of production. A fair amount of water, and you would freeze the area with an ammonia wall and all sorts of stuff. It's the energy intensity is mind-boggling.
I'd like just to ask the speakers to not forget about the repeating the question before the answer starts.
Can I make just one point about this? Is that it brings into one of the themes has been the question of, do we have adequate benchmarking to understand where we begin and where we're going? What type of monitoring systems are in place? What kind of plans are in place with regard to moving forward to avoid a range of issues and understand where the pluses and benefits are? To look at extraction of bitumen that requires a massive amount of relatively clean energy in the form of natural gas to extract extremely dirty energy in the form of bitumen is a large policy question that needs to be addressed effectively in the public realm. The issue of building a large fleet of nuclear reactors in order to heat water to extract bitumen is a large question. Where we are presently is stumbling forward into a series of commitments with a huge amount of capital expenditure to build an extracting system for dirty fossil fuel. The history of dirty fossil fuel in the form of oil is one of contamination of populations, destruction of ecosystems, impact upon the globe in terms of a national security threat in terms of global climate change. We do not have an international or a series of national policies to understand, measure, or follow the impact of these investments. One of the things that is on the table is a moratorium on increased development of tar sands extraction in order to come up to speed with these range of metrics, public systems in order to create plans and to monitor the impact and problematic impacts of not following the plans or standards that we deem appropriate. I think we have before us a question of where will we move in terms of a clean energy economy. Continued investment in tar sands extraction will suck a huge amount of dollars into building a system that does worse what we have already in place today in terms of an insecure, volatile, and highly expensive oil system. It's something that we may not pay at the pump immediately, but make no mistake, we pay for it in terms of military exposure, the health and safety of our lungs and economic shocks. What we have now is an opportunity and a need to stay the speed of development of what is an investment in a highly controversial, highly destructive, and highly dirty fuel economy.
Yes.
The question is to talk a bit about some of the known impacts of bitumen extraction in the region, and as well as I was testifying at before the Senate committee in Ottawa and ran into a little bit of turbulence there. Okay, the known health impacts. The World Health Organization actually has a report out on bitumen, and because an enormous number of people around the world have been exposed to asphalt, work with asphalt, and the resource in Fort McMurray is basically, you know, it's asphalt, it's light oil that bacteria has turned into this gooey stuff, and what you find is that there really hasn't been a lot of studies. But there are a lot of indications that it contains a lot of cancer-causing stuff. Now, the big health issue that has been raised downstream from Fort McMurray is that in the community of Fort Chip, where a number of extremely rare cancers have been reported, in particular bile duct cancers. There's blood cancers, cancers of the brain, cancers of the testes, stuff that medical people say, you know, this is unusual and this is rare. So, do we have an explanation for why these cancers are appearing in this community of 1,000 people downstream? At this point in time, we don't. We haven't done the proper studies. All we know is that this community has 30% more cancers than what they typically should have. We also know that Aboriginal communities, as a general rule, in rural areas in Canada, have very low rates of cancer because they're not surrounded by industry. We know that communities that live in major oil fields tend to have very high rates of cancer. So we need a study, a really good study that gets to the bottom of some of these issues. We also know that polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are one of the big issues in the tailings ponds, one of the big byproducts also of bitumen production, is a problematic player probably in all of this. Now the other question about testifying before the Senate committee. I mean, I'll make it really short. Dr. John O'Connor and I were invited to talk to a Senate committee looking at water issues in the tar sands. And we were just asked as citizens to do so. And we gladly complied. And we both told our stories. John talked about the fact that he was the medical examiner in the region and had encountered these rare cancers and had asked a few questions about it and then found himself being accused of causing undue alarm in the community and being hauled before the Alberta Physicians of Alberta College of Physicians and Surgeons by members of Health Canada, an extraordinary event. We found that many members of the committee, it's not a big deal. As a reporter, I'm quite well known to be an edgy sort of fellow, and many members of the committee had some issues with this, but that's par for the course. I mean, this is a hot button issue in Canada right now,
Tom, how did you want to?
I would just add very, very briefly. I think what Andrew said around the cancer issues in Fort Chip, what we know, what we don't know, I largely agree with, and we're very supportive of further studies because we really aren't to the bottom of, you know, what the causality is on this certain isolated pocket of fairly exotic cancers occurring in this area.
I grew up in Texas, and I know that, you know, oil production and refining is not the cleanest thing in the world in any form. But the question is twofold. Do you have there's plenty of conventional oil production in Alberta. Do you have a problem with that? And secondly, what percentage of the total production is represented by the bitumen? In other words, if we didn't touch the bitumen, how much conventional oil could we extract there?
Do you want to take that, Paul? Do you take that first? Repeat the question.
It's basically how do folks feel about the conventional oil and gas sector in Alberta, and what percentage of the production is on the oil sands side? Now, obviously, we're very supportive of ongoing and continuing conventional oil and gas production in Alberta, which is an industry that's been around for most of a century and has been very productive and has provided a very high volume of exports to the United States. There's really no way around the fact that conventional oil production in Alberta and probably gas production as well is declining. Gas production from shale in northeast BC is going to rise, it looks like, as it has in many regions of the United States. I'm really sorry I don't remember the ratio right, but of the couple million barrels a day of production in Alberta, over half of it at this point is oil sands. That ratio is going to shift further and further in an oil sands direction. If you look at long-term projections of Canadian production, one is a rising wedge and the other is clearly a declining wedge. And I don't think there's anybody out there that I'm aware of who disagrees that the ratio is going that direction, or at least that the conventional is declining.
Yeah, Tom's got the ratio correct, and conventional supplies are declining rapidly in Alberta as they are elsewhere on the continent. I've talked to a number of geologists who suggest that there really is more conventional oil in the province, but it's very small pockets and small pools, and that really we should be encouraging production of this resource, as opposed to accelerating production in the tar sands. And I find that an interesting argument, and it's out there. And these are pretty seasoned geologists in the province who say, look, we've rushed a little too fast on, and everything in the tar sands, we know where it is, and it's generally easy to get at, but where are the incentives to go after some of the low carbon stuff that's still out there? And I think that comes back to another thing that I think it's really important for jurisdictions that have hydrocarbons that they be very transparent and map the carbon intensity of the resource and map the energy intensity of the resource so that we know how much energy we're spending to get more energy, and the two figures will be strongly related. And it's another argument for conservation too, that light oil is a pretty precious thing.
Yes?
Sure. I'm happy to take a crack at that. I mean, the question is, how do I disagree with Andrew, and how would I respond to, his view that the oil sands intensity is maybe two or three times in some cases that of conventional versus our argument that it's probably more in the 10 or 15%, and according to some people who've looked at it hard, somewhat above that. I would absolutely agree. This is a very hard calculus because you have land impacts, you have transport impacts, you have associated, you have gas flaring impacts. It's not simple. I think the study that we referred to that the Alberta Energy Research Institute sponsored and Jacobs produced is probably the most serious effort to gather all the pieces. Even in the short few months since that study came out, people have pointed out two or three pieces that are missing in that one. The land disturbance is perhaps not adequately captured. On the other hand, cogeneration,
which reduces the net carbon footprint of the oil sands, is not captured adequately in that study either. And, you know, we were talking a little bit about, you know, David Keith, a noted climate change scientist in Canada, very, very respected guy. I guess I would characterize David's comments around this a little differently, that David has noted that the ARRI study and others are definitely imperfect. I don't think he thinks that the ARRI study coming in at 5 to 15% greater than an average basket of crude, I don't think he thinks it's orders of magnitude wrong. I think he thinks it is imperfect, and I don't think he would argue that it's two or three times or probably even anything like 30% greater, but I guess we ought to let David speak for himself, and my guess is his views are probably out on the Internet. David speaks quite a bit. So, yeah, that's, I mean, it's a very complicated engineering question of finding, you know, all the different carbon footprint aspects of any given petroleum product from the time you produce it, process it, transport it, you know, refine it, have land impacts, have flaring impacts, and finally get it, you know, to somebody's SUV and have them drive it down the street. I don't think anybody's going to argue any of the studies have been perfect yet in capturing all the pieces of that. We think it's 5 to 15%. I mean, I'm not one of the Jacobs, engineers who did this study, and they have their stuff out, you know, out available in the public domain for people to look at.
Yes. Earlier this year, when President Obama visited Toronto, Ottawa, there was a lot of talk about how the tar sands would be treated in U.S. climate legislation on the federal level. So I'm wondering if you could speak to
the question is, and I suspect there are other folks who'd love to answer that one as well, how we would expect the oil sands to be treated under U.S. Climate legislation. Obviously, U.S. climate legislation is a very, very moving target. When the president visited Ontario, he talked about how the oil sands have some analogies to coal in the United States, that both are strategic resources for North America. Both face significant carbon challenges, but the technology is probably key to try to drive towards a better carbon footprint with both of them. Carbon capture and storage may, in fact, have some application to both. You know, moving forward since then, the administration has said more and more positive things. I referenced David Goldwyn earlier, Secretary Clinton's energy advisor. He has said publicly that, you know, on balance, they believe the oil sands are very, very positive for American energy security. Secretary Clinton had very positive language balancing environment, energy security, and economics in the permit for the Enbridge Alberta Clipper pipeline. But to try to get more specifically to your question of how it will be treated in American climate change legislation, that I think gets back to the question of, are low carbon fuel standards part of the American approach to climate change policy? They were in an earlier draft of the Waxman bill. They're not in the bill that came out of the House. I don't think anybody doubts that discussion will begin again. Our preference is something that looks much more like Waxman, where you impose a cost of carbon, and each producer of a carbon-containing product, a petroleum product, has to deal with that. There is also the issue of whether or not there would be carbon border adjustments in American legislation. And what would be required for any given country to satisfy that American standard. It's sort of commenting on a moving target. Obviously, our view is that, you know, Canada should not be discriminated against in the American approach, that Canada will ultimately have a climate change policy that is compatible, aligned, comparable. You know, you can pick a lot of different words, and that's the public position of the Canadian government. But I'm sort of being, you know, we're all sort of being asked to speculate on a moving target that we really don't know where it's going to come out. Obviously, our view is we don't want discrimination. We want an even price of carbon across North America.
Yeah, I think it's the idea of a moving target with regard to climate legislation coming out of the Senate is absolutely right. And it's like a lot of political process, it is indeed complicated and not necessarily transparent. Our view is that a low carbon fuel standard is very important with regard to helping shift the economic signals that will induce investment into a cleaner fuel economy. That putting a price on carbon is absolutely critical. The question of how it is done, when it is done, and when it starts starts kicking in is critical in terms of will be able to mitigate more effectively sooner than later. But looking at the whole issue of the movement of fuels and fuel resources, it is, in our view, critical to have multiple points of address in terms of giving clear economic signals on what needs to happen in terms of moving into a cleaner fuel economy. So we would support that, and we will support that in the Senate. Again, it is difficult to prognosticate on that, but it could have a significant benefit in terms of helping move away from a mobile fuel economy that is essentially subsidized and insecure.
Was there a questioner over here that... No?
Somebody in the back.
Yes, there, in the back.
One thing. The question is from the point of view of Fish and Wildlife. What is the footprint of the actual extraction in Alberta, and what's the impact on fish and wildlife? One of NRDC's attention on this has been on the impact on migratory fowl, and we have a report which you can see online, NRDC. .org. It's called Trouble in the Nursery, and it looks at the impact and disturbance of 30% of the migratory fowl in North America. A large number in the Midwest are being severely affected with regard to their habitat in Alberta. So we see this from the point of view of migratory fowl as a major disruption. Given the fact that we're looking at a disruption of the largest intact ecosystem in North America, which also fits into what the carbon footprint of this is as well in terms of absorption of CO2. Talk about the fish.
Just a word or two on the scale of the project. I mean, the resource lies under an area approximately 140,000 square kilometers as an area the size of Florida. 60% of that land has now been leased. The majority of that is for steam plant production. About 5,000 square kilometers has been directly set aside for open pit mining. The implications for wildlife are, we're really talking about industrializing an area the size of Florida, so there'll be extensive forest fragmentation. Studies by Brad Stelfox, who's Alberta's leading land use ecologist, have indicated that, you know, in some areas of tar sands development, we're looking at, you know, the diminishment of wildlife species by 80%. So woodland caribou will be gone, lynx will be gone, moose will be gone, and most of the fish will be gone. The open pit mines, I mean, are on average destroy 14 rivers, streams, and per every mine. I mean, Imperial's Kerr Lake mine occupies an area of 70 square miles. That's, you know, the city of Seattle is an area of 92 square miles. Now, briefly, in terms of reclamation, the companies are required to reclaim the disturbed mining sites. Very little has yet been reclaimed or officially certified. There are a lot of issues, the same kind of issues that one finds with mountaintop removal in Appalachia, diminishment of biodiversity. In many cases, they're going to have to be planting salt-tolerant trees, salt-tolerant shrubs,
Wetlands will not be replaced, and 50% of the area is essentially wetland, bogs and peatland. So really, really critical and important reclamation issues. Essentially, a lot of this land will be sacrificed.
Sacrifice is not a word I would use. Impacted is a word we can't possibly deny. Put a little perspective on it. The area that will be mined is roughly 0.1% of the Canadian boreal forest. Andrew is right. There's also an impact, but vastly lesser to the in situ development areas. But again, 0.1% of the Canadian boreal forest, the area that will be mined, and it's an area not the size of Florida. It's about an area about the size of Tampa. It will be restored. I cannot contest the point that restoration is at this point imperfect, but restoration is getting better. It will get better. And actually, though, only one block of land has actually been recertified and turned back to the province of Alberta. Quite a bit is in the cycle and is being restored, but you can't turn it back to the province until you're literally out of the area and turning the land back over. So if there are other contiguous parts of the project going on, even though you've done restoration, you wouldn't turn it back at that point. Thank you.
I just have one question. In talking about the incidence of cancer, you talked about it as a relatively small pocket of extraordinary cancer impact. You're talking about the relatively small footprint of the disturbance of the boreal forest, and the relatively small use of water and the small impact upon the water resource. Do you think we're just nuts? That we're looking at the fact that we think this is problematic in the destruction of the largest intact ecosystem in North America, with a threat to the extirpation of a large part of the wildlife in North America, with an impact on the third largest watershed in North America, that we've either got bad information or it's really not that big a deal and you can take care of it after you've extracted your hydrocarbons.
Well, I thought we were letting the audience ask the questions, but
I just asked a question.
But I guess you did, and I'd be happy to take it.
It's like you're saying that what we're talking about doesn't exist and doesn't matter.
I don't think I've at any point said it doesn't exist. I haven't at any point said there aren't environmental impacts, that there isn't an importance of raising the bar. Okay, well, maybe my position is that you're heavily exaggerating it, and clearly we have a very different perspective. We probably also have a very, very different perspective on realistically how fast the world is moving out of a hydrocarbon environment, and that's probably a long discussion that we could have around that one. I suspect I don't know what you think. Maybe you think it's 10 or 20 years. We think probably 40 or 50 years is a more reasonable time frame, and that in that time we're going to need to develop hydrocarbons. We're going to need to develop them as responsibly as we can. You've talked a lot about the military cost of a hydrocarbon industry. Well, here's something to think about. When you deliver it by pipelines from your friends and allies who are reliable people who live to the north, you don't have to have large military expenses around your hydrocarbons, and that's a very positive factor that I think the Obama administration has very clearly recognized as they've taken a hard look at this. And obviously the Obama administration is a group of people that's very concerned with environmental protection.
I'm a retired dean. Actually, I'm not going to answer your question, but I'm going to say that one of the things which has interested me is that this discussion today is taking place about a week or so after a very unusual event in Canada. In fact, on the watershed of the St. Lawrence River, about a week or so ago, some thousands of Canadians living in this watershed in the St. Lawrence River, which is linked up to the Great Lakes, woke up and found that the river had turned blue. I'm not kidding. The St. Lawrence River had turned blue. It was some sort of algae, apparently. It was serious because the authorities immediately said, "Don't drink it." and even be careful about using it to wash yourself. What it did illustrate to me was the fragility of the environment, which is something that we're talking about. And I'm not too sure that, I think it's faded now, as far as I know. I'm not absolutely positive about that either. But the media, to get back to your point, the media reported it as kind of an odd event the morning when it happened, and then dropped it. But apparently won't come back to it. So I wouldn't rely on the media too much. I think there's been an increase in environmental journalism, environmental reporting, over the last 10 or 15 years, particularly in the U.S. I would try to come down every year to a certain number of functions, journalistic functions and journalism education functions. I would come down because it was a much bigger media world in the States, and it was very, very instructive for me to do that. But I'll have to, when I get back down east, I'll have to find out what happened to the Blue River.
So it's our notorious long attention span that might be the problem.
Yes.
I think that is one of the fundamental questions.
Could you repeat the question?
The question, that question being, what is the relationship of bitumen and as a fuel source for moving our vehicles and keeping us mobile versus other alternatives such as biofuels or electric vehicles? I think this is in fact a very important question about how the automobile industry and mobile industry has become completely tied to oil as the means of moving equipment. If we look at the beginning of the car era, the Model T Ford, for instance, was a flex fuel vehicle that could run on gasoline or on biofuels, and actually got more mileage than the average Ford fleet does today. And it raises the question of, when you're looking at essentially about 90% of vehicles depend upon petroleum to move them in some form or another, is this essentially a stable way for us to have that part of our economy? And I think these are among the questions that need to be asked. A journalist, two journalists, in fact, at The Economist, published a book about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, Zoom, which is about the race for the new car, which is premised upon the fact that we need to build fleets that do not rely upon hydrocarbons to move, that it is fundamentally unsustainable, that it is bad for the economy, that it is a form of monopoly that is dramatically skewed toward a series of very limited economic interests. And they comment that it has been remarkable how the oil industry has been able to successfully conflate its narrow economic interest with public interest. I think it's the same issue with regard to the national security, global security, and the conflation of essentially the security of the major oil companies with the public interest. It is a reliance that is unsustainable, and we must right now start designing our way out of. And we look at tar sands as a move toward
an unconventional, much dirtier oil, as rather than being, this is a relief because somehow we'll buy us security, economic and national security, is the wrong take on that. The right take is, this is truly a warning sign that the nature of our addiction to oil is so horrible that it is like saying, you know, we're not getting enough really pure heroin, can't we mix it with rat poison? And that's the oil question with regard to the move to tar sands. It's fundamentally a warning sign that we need to put in place the range of tools, like a price on carbon, like a low carbon fuel standard, like shining a light on the fact that oil is not really a commodity. It is dominated by families and groups with flags, the majors who are exploiting the tar sands area have about 10% of the source of crude. It is their play for their own security, not our security. Their interest, not the public interest. I'd like you guys to write about that.
I'm going to be bad and ask you to, in a very capsule form, run the question back by me again. I got caught up in the answer.
Basically, I guess the point I was making, which I was hoping you could reflect on, was that it's not sustainable to run automobiles.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Right. There was a lot in the beginning of the answer that I actually agreed with. I mean, certainly in terms of things like, does it make sense in public policy to try to see if there are appropriate ways to enable a movement towards natural gas-driven vehicles? We think that's something that ought to be explored. Now, obviously, that's a hydrocarbon. It's a cleaner hydrocarbon. You made a great point in the premise of your question around coal in the United States. Is a move to electricity-driven vehicles in the United States all that much cleaner if we're heavily coal-reliant? And we can also get into, biofuels. I mean, most of what I read, next generation biofuels might in fact get us to a very positive place. Current generation biofuels probably don't. And in fact, from everything we've seen, corn-based ethanol uses an awful lot more water per unit of energy than the oil sands and has a much less positive energy balance than the oil sands. That is definitely not a place that gets you to a better position even than an increasingly heavy oil barrel does. But all those other options are very, very appropriate to be looked at, and people ought to be. And I think it is an interesting and valid point, and maybe a new paradigm, that there used to be a multitude of sources and models around automobiles. It does seem fairly likely, and I think positive, that we are going to move towards a world where, again, there are a multitude of fuel sources supporting vehicles.
We're out of time, unfortunately. The two speakers that have just preceded me gave almost a kind of summary in their answers to some extent for what they've taken out of the discussion. I don't know whether Andrew wants to take just a short time to add his third element to that or not.
I would just simply say that the rapid development of the tar sands to me is a real signal that peak oil has arrived. It is a dramatic event. It is an extraordinary event, and it is unprecedented in the sense that we are now running on a resource, that looks like asphalt, smells like asphalt, and behaves like asphalt. Really, there needs to be concerted debate in both Canada and the United States about how long can we sustain this addiction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the panel also for a very, very interesting discussion. And